starting the recording now. I hope, yes I am, yeah. Yes, so I was going to... Oh, Delphine. Yes, hello. Yes. So we've got to... I've got to remember extra names, add to the list. So last week we weren't very far into the lecture, were we? I usually forget what I've said, but I think that I tried to cover some important aspects of the lecture that we didn't get to, if you see what I mean. I jumped forward to try and get through. Morning, Wes. 2:30? Yes. Yes. You mean get out of here by 2:30, don't you? Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes, so I think it's worth going through the material that I kind of hurried through a little bit more slowly with Maturana, and then you might have noticed how halfway through the week I changed my mind about the second reading, Henry Bortoft. We'll be doing that next week. I woke up really with the sense that if all we're going to say about the origin of language is what Maturana has to say, it doesn't really give you a context. If there's a spectrum of ideas about the origin of language, then Maturana's on quite, he's an outlier in a way. You know, there's a mainstream view that has quite a different idea about language, as you probably know. So I had a kind of an academic's conscience that I was going to give a course where you didn't really get that broader view. So I chose McGilchrist, who's also a bit of an outlier, but not quite so far. Do you know the word triangulation, where you look at something from two or three viewpoints? And I wanted to look at what Maturana has to say from another viewpoint. If you know how I teach, it's not a matter of having an argument between these two people. It's a matter, I think, that they're both looking at the same thing from a different place. And in a way, if we both look at the same thing from a different place, you get to see it better. That's really the idea of McGilchrist. But he also has a whole view that's in this book, which I don't know if you've read it or not. He's much better known than Maturana in the, you know, in the public realm. He's quite famous speaker and teaches at Dartington Schumacher College. But I don't know if you know about Schumacher College. Should I say about Schumacher? Does anybody know about Schumacher College? No. Small is beautiful. Does that ring any bells from anyone who might remember the 60s? Schumacher, yes, he wrote a book about how much better the world would be if we didn't have all these huge organisations, and the college was named after him. Just thought I mentioned Schumacher because in the world of alternative education, Schumacher is probably the of course. Free University of Brighton is the pinnacle of alternative education, is it? But for actual, you know, mainstream, give you a qualification, pay fees, Schumacher College stands out there as something that still is really in the business of attempting to provide a genuine understanding of what's going on in the world. Rather than, what am I going to say? Rather than, am I saying that Sussex University isn't doing that? Well, I'm on tape, aren't I? And it's a broad question, but I just thought I'd mention Schumacher just as an example of somewhere that's teaching holistic science. Actually, that's one of its. That's probably for me. It's its main course. Where quite a lot of the material that we're dealing with here, they would teach there, and it's not very common that this kind of material is covered in our society, because I'm reminded about how I woke up this morning. I was flicking through the TV last night. All right, just a little digression. You know, you just finish watching my program. Suddenly, bam! I'm into one of these chat shows where I think one of the Labour politicians who's standing for the leadership just started going on about climate change and what's wrong, how we should be doing this and we should be doing that and we should be doing that, and everyone's clapping. I guess from my perspective on something like that is I know nothing's going to happen. And the interesting question is why? What's going on? What is it? If you're going to say there's something wrong, and I think most of us have a sort of a sense, we say, yes, something's wrong, but what's wrong? Surely that's the question. I don't know the woman's name, but our world is full of people who think they know what's wrong, and are just going, what we need to do is this, and the actual question, what's wrong, is a sort of assumed it's answered, but of course everyone's got a different answer, but the actual task of looking in to maybe what is wrong, or is there anything wrong even, you know, is to think that it's wrong in itself part of the problem. That sort of is what, in a way, for me, is what distinguishes being political from being philosophical, if you like. Being philosophical, I guess the deep question for us is, well, what's wrong? What's the source of this sort of crisis that we're observing unfolding? We're observing a crisis unfolding, aren't we? And the sort of deep question is, what's behind it? What's even the cause is maybe a wrong word. And so, the beginning of this course is partially looking into, so what is it to be human? Which is part, in a way, it's addressing that question. I'm not saying there's something wrong with being human. I'm saying, well, what's our situation here? What are we capable of, even? And our public discourse is by and large a pointing affair. You can feel there's a finger pointing. Yeah, it's pointing. And, you know, I guess you would see that if I'm going to have to go on one side of the politics, I'd go on the left side of politics. But the left side is points just as hard as the right, really, in that way. It's the pointing that's the that's something that should be questioned, really. But that leads us back into... for me, it leads us straight back into Jungian psychology, into the idea of what's unacknowledged in ourselves, is what pointing is you're pointing to what you can't acknowledge in yourself, and that doesn't mean just that you are what you're pointing at. It just means that you're projecting it in a way that just exacerbates the division. But I'm digressing, of course, but I'm just giving a... yes.
I was recently engaging in some kind of posting and reposting in Facebook about this issue of left and right in the political sense, and I was like, we were trying to kind of figure out what is the emotions behind being in the left and what are the emotions behind being in the right.
Yes.
So I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, because my kind of initial thing was, Well, the right are kind of coming from the point of view of fear, lack, selfishness, wanting to protect my own interests. Left is more like connected to love, trying to be kind of, you know, but I don't know if this is actually what's happening. Or
well, you're thinking what I'm... You're reminding me that I was thinking the same thing from the last lecture. You know that we were looking at this. There's this long history which Maturana is pointing at, that's saying that the human race was living in some sort of state of cooperation and harmony together, and that our recent eruption, I don't know what the word is, agricultural and then industrial civilization is a break with that, and this whole idea that there's an aggressive non-cooperative isolationist individualistic aspect to that form of society compared to Buddhism. And I thought too, so you'd sort of say, well, the Labour and the party and the left are generally on the side of the people, of being of the cooperativeness of what we would say was that former state, and the right seem to be on the side of this individualistic, competitive, aggressive side. And I think you could say that the deeper, I think, inspiration of people who are not all, but a lot of people in the left and in the ecology movement are motivated by that. You know, the people on the right, you know, with the sort of world we live in, well, I don't know any of them. And that's a joke. But, but generally it's like that. I don't know any of them. You know, I don't talk to them. I don't have anything to do with them. They're wicked, wicked people.
You know,
I guess that's what I... Yes.
But then if we start to say things like this, yes, we are, in effect, being this, so if you then go with, well, what your point is, so if we're pointing at the right and we say, well, you're selfish,
precise and more.
How we kind
yes.
of, so what are they pointing at us that they're not acknowledging then? So
their hearts.
Yeah.
Their craving and need for love.
Mm.
That's what's, you know, it's somewhere, you know. I know we are digressing big time here. Yes. Yeah, and Nicolette, of course. Nicolette gave me a good talking to last week. She really wants to get through the slides. She really wants to. So let's.
Yes.
No, I know. Yes. Yes, there's a lack of compassion and understanding on both sides. And I mean, my experience of the left when I was at university many years ago was that the worst of it was between the factions in the left. And, you know, when Jeremy Corbyn was kind of turned up, I thought, what's happening in the Labour Party? I'll go to one of the meetings. And there it was. The Corbynistas, they were all pointing at the others who you know, this was the very first, you know, almost the day after he was first elected as leader. And I thought, oh no, we're back again. It's the Socialist Workers' Party and the Communists that really hated each other, you know, at Warwick.
I like Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes. So I'm saying nothing about any of the individuals. It's the behaviours. It's the form of the behaviour that's sort of staring us in the face, yeah, isn't it?
It's like old school vegans that used to go, corpse crunchers and as those are passing the milk and things, and weren't attracting other people to be vegan because they were quite enjoying being special. Yeah. So I was vegan then and I'm vegan now. But I remember back like 20 years ago, so I was in Wales and quite a few of the sort of hardcore, they were hardcore hunt sabbers and things, and they didn't really want anyone to be in their gang. They
yes.
Like, oh, you're all...
Yes.
Yeah, new vegans seem to say, come, everybody can all do this and we can all live better.
Yes. Yes. So what? So we... I guess we're... what am I saying? We need to feel some more compassion for all of those Oxbridge graduates who are running the country.
Yeah. I said that the other day. My husband got really angry with me about Boris Johnson, about what this, he's just this sad boy that's all been crushed and
yes.
when he was little.
Imagine what happened to them at Eton. Oh, God.
He's got no heart.
Poor, yeah. Poor little boys mangled through that system.
He's a bit childish, isn't he?
He's very childish.
Yeah.
He behaves like a child. Maybe yeah.
I will finish here. I feel like if we just peeled the layers back far enough, there'd just be a great pile of people sobbing about it, really, about the situation we're in on both sides.
Sharon was saying some of the things that I was listening this week, and he was saying about the most important, about everybody being born in trust. Every baby is born trusting that there will be people that will love them and feed them and cuddle them and everything. And the most important thing being that you understand that you're a loving creature, a loving organism. So when people get told you're a load of rubbish, then they don't think I'm a loving organism anymore. It's that simple.
Yes.
Understand that your essential nature is to be a loving organism.
Yes.
People get all kinds of ideas about what they should be.
Yes. Now, I guess, and I will get going, honestly, Nicolette. One of the reasons I introduced McGilchrist, I guess, is to give some more balance to the other side. What's this other side in us? Do you know? Because he's... It's clear that we would all like to be loving, I think, at a certain level, and yet it hasn't worked out. It hasn't worked out. Yes. Hello, Scott. Where are all the examples of all of the people who are living together in loving harmony, living an entirely different life?
Amazon.
In where?
The Amazon.
Yeah, I guess I meant in England. I meant amongst us.
Quakers, they're quite good.
Well, a friend of mine's just got involved with them, yes. But I mean, in such a way that. As they're saying, look, it's working. You see how we're living together? Come and join us. Do you see, in a way, it's if there were a group of people who are living together in loving harmony, and were able to organise their lives in that way, if it were genuine, if you use the right word, then we would all be attracted toward that, wouldn't we? It wouldn't be a secret. It wouldn't be somebody's managed to do it in a privately. If it were an easy thing to achieve, it would have happened in the 60s, let's say. But in effect, if you look at all of the attempts that people have made to live together communally in a different way, in a non-competitive way. I don't want to say they've all failed, but they haven't. The wildfire hasn't happened.
Yes, because it requires people to isolate themselves, because everything belongs to somebody, so you have to have a place to be, and then that becomes exclusive because there's only room for those people. And so then you're like a bubble rather than being something that can permeate.
Oh, I reckon. Yes. Have we got a? Oh, we've got a chair for you. Yes. Yes.
Well, maybe everybody is to some degree. It's just, you know, everybody's your family and your interactions with people that you love. It's happening everywhere, but there's other stuff happening as well. You know,
I guess, but
the purity of being always perfect, but everybody's.
Oh yes, keep
their best.
Keep coming. I think we need to find another chair.
Yes,
one more chair. Oh, yes.
No problem.
We've got two more chairs.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, the next person who comes, we have to start taking things from the kitchen. Yes, if you would, Nick, just because I think if I know Anthony will be here in about 5:30.
Yes.
Yes. Oh yeah, there's another one there. Yes. Good.
Should we move up and then?
Yes, I want to keep everyone in a circle, so if we can, somebody can sit right next to me. You know, rather than everybody. I don't like anyone getting hidden in the background.
Sorry.
Yes, I'm only mentioning something that I just. I'm talking to this. So what's... what's the situation with us? Why haven't we been able... all of our attempts to create alternative societies in the West... I don't want to say that they've completely failed. But they haven't... taken flight. Do you know when something just spreads... And works. Things have worked for a little while, and then they collapse. And generally, I've been involved in a couple of things that have collapsed, and it's quite it's.
I think it's because we don't know how to fight properly. Animals have conflict with each other, but a lot of species resolve their conflicts by making the right gestures and the right movements. So, for instance, you know, exposing your throat is a sign that you accept that the other person is stronger than you, and then, you know, life in the wolf pack goes on. I think that with human beings, my feeling is that conflicts are natural and normal and perfectly healthy, in my opinion, but my experience has been that they tend to escalate. People don't know how to manage them. It's almost as though being disagreed with or being opposed is like the end of the world for some people.
Ego
comes in, doesn't it? It's not about that. I think if systems are going to survive, they've got to allow for something other than loving cooperation. Otherwise, we'd all be terrifying saints, wouldn't we? Stepford Wives. I think we've got to find a place for anger, we've got to find a place for resentment, we've got to find a place for all these human emotions, and see that it's perfectly okay to express them. It's not the end of the world, it's not the dissolution of the group, it's not... But somehow people can't seem to tolerate that very well. We haven't learned how to deal with those things. That's just my opinion.
Yes.
My experience.
But that this is today. I wake up with certain things. I'm just putting it on the table, and I'm not giving an answer. I'm just sort of. I just like us to recognise that it hasn't happened, and that there are many people think that they know why, but it still hasn't happened.
I think that's what yes. I think is one reason.
Yes,
I've seen it happen in a lot of.
But that's what we do, don't we? We do that, Maria. We do search for reasons, and we have opinions, and our search for reasons and opinions is usually where we get lost. We don't have any real knowledge.
Well, that's because we don't, as you say yourself, we don't take it a step. We're so busy pointing at the problem. That we don't step back and think, okay, well, let's approach it from how can we have a solution to this?
But not even a solution. I guess my impulse in this, even at FUB, is no, let's forget the solution. Let's just find out how it actually is. You know, my sense is always if we get down deep enough to how it actually is, everything else is going to be revealed. Maybe the conclusion will be, well, this is how it has to be. I know that nobody likes that sort of fatalistic conclusion. I'm sorry, my glasses I've got clear vision that's blurred if I take them off or cloudy. I'll clean them later. So having said that, that was a, I know, just a sort of a sense of what we're talking about here. And also culturally, just to come back to the lecture, we live in a culture that essentially has no answer to that question. And at one level just ignores it. And another level, at a slightly deeper level, there's a, and this would be in academia, amongst the people who think about it all, I think there's a general sort of feeling of fatalism, that it's never going to be resolved. We're just going to end up with a bunch of positions, and we're just going to argue it out and have differences of opinion, that's what we've been doing for so long, that there's a sense that it'll never change. One person thinks it's this, one person thinks it's that, and the other person thinks it's that. You argue it out, and generally you come to a kind of a group of people, sort of in academia, come to a consensus for a little while, and then it changes, and then a new school arises, and an old one falls, and you move in this domain of human opinion.
It has been known there's the system to reach, you know, the state where we live in harmony together. It's known, but it hasn't been implemented. Like with recently with Osho, before it was with Jesus and with the Buddha, they basically say the same thing. It's just it's about the awareness of your destructive impulses and admitting it to yourself and repenting.
Yes, repent. That's a good word. It's a good word.
By,
yes.
By becoming realizing that they are deceptive and trying not to repeat this, to admit it. Yeah.
Yes. Now, but do you see that the temptation for us all is always to say, "Well, it's because of this," I don't think we.
Feel good about themselves, and they do good, what we perceive as good, to other people and by other people. Is it not just hurt, but lack of love?
Lack of love. I mean, if I was going to name it, hello. Yes. No. I guess if I was to say it as simply as I could, it would be that. It would be we haven't, you know, not the reasons, but I think at a certain level recognise that there's a lack of love is behind it. Yes.
Just one thing about the sense of fatalism.
Yes.
That you described about when you kind of experience the debate and the thing that nothing changes and or things come and go and change all over the place. So that is quite a mirror of what happens in nature anyway, because nature, you have one species and then other species come and changes and weather and this and that, and something works for a while and then it stops working and there is a change anyway. So if you took human society aside for a moment, if you look at what happens in nature, does that make you feel fatalistic? Oh, you know, those lions, they're still, after all those years, they're still eating the weak,
I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Does that kind of depress us, the state of nature itself? Because if living human society aside, you can look at nature and either say, well, I'm really kind of happy about this situation, or it didn't
just reminded me of my picture. Yeah. If it's not a lion, it's a tiger, but anyway.
Did you take that picture?
No. It's quite several people have brought up lion cubs or tiger cubs, and they end up as pets, you know. But I find the image of it is... Yes, so... There's a level where if you just can consider us to be part of the natural system, then we're just doing what we have to do. This is where we're at in our stage of evolution, and the way that we're working things out is the way we have to work things out. And one of the things that we do is we wring our hands and say, "Oh, it shouldn't be this way." And there's a sort of a level where, you know, there's a position you can take where you say, "Well, no, it's of course it's."
Well, there's nothing natural about the way we live, though, is there? We're not. I mean, although we are animals, if you look at the way we live, it's certainly not part of nature, is it? We've divorced ourselves from that.
Well,
and what do we mean by human nature anyway?
One of the things I think we should need to see, because we're dealing with language, is we draw the distinction there. We say that our way of life is unnatural because we've got an idea of nature. I don't know why you remind me of when I was in India many years ago, and they had this great drink. It's because it's very Indian. No natural ingredients whatsoever. But of course they're all, well, it's all made of chemicals, right? It's made of a chemical. Well, what? Mm-hmm. Everything's made of chemicals.
Indeed.
When does it become unnatural? When the humans do something to it? Well, are we not part of nature? Do you see what we've already got? A thing where we think, oh yeah, there's a great chasm there. Where we
downstream of people, isn't it? Things which are unnatural, things that people have produced. All the natural things that are upstream that go through.
I mean, there's all the rocks are saying, you know, this is natural, not all those plants. Yeah, this is how it should be. Look at Mars, you know. Those plants are so unnatural. Do you see? It's all where we draw the line in a way. Look, Nicolette's on me. I can hear. I'm going to go back, and we're going to do this lecture because at least we have to get to the end of Maturana before we have lunch. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's get back into his language. I think, Ashik, you sent me a...
Coordination of coordination.
Yes, yes.
You did not come with a better term.
Yes. There's a certain pace of language that Maturana uses that's quite repetitive in its way and quite and sounds unnecessarily complex. You think there could be a much simpler way of saying this. But this is his way. So there's a certain style of expression that he has. And it's not just, I think, that English is his second language, but he means it to be very precise. He's actually being quite precise in what he's saying. And it sounds maybe a bit pedantic. He'll repeat something over and over rather than abbreviate it. And I guess, particularly now I'm teaching it, I'm getting more of a sense of respect for the fact that he does intend to be clear. First up, you think he's trying to be obscure, but he's not. And I think, as I tried to explain last time, there's a lot behind what he's saying that's in cybernetics and systems theory that means that we can't, in two lectures, really get to the full depths of his view, which is quite, if you get interested in him, it's quite worthwhile to go into it, but it would be almost an entire course to go into the deeper meanings of systems theory. I mean, I was a little bit tempted. I pulled out one of my lectures from Sussex and one wondered. I know Boris likes this, yeah. But I think we have to, in a way, be aware that when we're dealing with Maturana, There's a deeper level to him that we just don't have time to go into, but part of the difficulty of his language is to do with that. So saying that, language is a manner of living in recurrent interactions in a flow of coordinations of consensual behaviours. This is an example, I think, of one of those sentences. So recurrence for him is a technical term. So one of the but it's to do with, you know, he's going to use the word recursive later. It's to do with when something repeats, and he's looking at all of human behaviour as a kind of having a certain form, and he's trying to describe the forms of our behaviour. And you might notice that he doesn't talk about consciousness. He's got quite an interesting theory of what our cognition is, which I don't actually agree with. He doesn't think that we actually are in touch with anything but states of our own nervous system, which in a way he's correct and in a way he's not. It depends how you understand it. And that's another area where I don't think I want to go off into that, because it would involve explaining all of Maturana's thinking. But at this level, he's seeing language as a recursive behaviour that we exhibit between ourselves. Recursive meaning I say something, you say something, I say something, you say something, I say something, you say something. So in a sense, if you were to just look at two people talking, it would look like nothing's happening. There's just a... I mean, we tend to think it's a bing ba bong, but in a way it's circular, because what I say changes what you say, and what you say changes what I say. And in a certain way, it's a behaviour of our bodies involving our nervous systems. So he's thinking in that level. His word consensual is referring to the fact that it's not... you know, later he uses the word stipulate, yes. It's not imposed, essentially. Our ordinary languaging isn't an imposed... one person doesn't impose it on another as a system of rules, except when you get in the army, or, you know, there are certain situations where it does get that way. But in language, in relation to how it came about, it was essentially consensual. I mean, Heidegger and Fink would say that it's a form of play. That's another way of saying what consensual means. Play being more than just a game. If you know Wittgenstein, he regarded language as a game, as a kind of game. But not just a fixed game, a game where you can continuously invent new rules as you go along. It's an opening out of a play space language, where I mean, often people think of language as you're trapped in language, in the subject object structure of language makes us see the world in a certain way. To which I say, well, just listen to us talking about it. Do you see how that whenever you talk about something in language, you can jump out and talk about what you're talking about. That's another form of recursion. Do you see what you can always leap out? Yes. But the recursive nature, it means that you can always step outside of the language game that you're playing and say, well, let's change the rules then. You don't like this? We can always you change it. We can use metaphor. We can take a word, and we can say, well, let's use it to refer to something else. And I'll endeavour to point out to you what that something else is, until you get the idea. And then we've got a new word and a new game. But you can only do this consensually. You can't sit down and order someone to play.
See, babies do that sometimes, like just before talking. Just before they start to talk, they start playing. They just make noises, and as if they're talking, but they're not saying. But you see, there's intonation in when they speak.
Yeah,
one
yeah.
speaks, and then another speaks, and then they pretend as if they're talking to each other. Sorry?
Communicate that
they communicate. They start making noises and they stop. And then the others start.
Have you done the second the reading? No, because we're coming to that. If we make it, in a way, because I did it for you, Alex, and Federico, and anyone else who's a musician. You know, because music, of course, is music and language is yes, they're related. And one of Maturana's views of language is that we can get into coordinated behaviour. All animals are in some form of coordinated behaviour with other animals and with the environment itself. And his view of language is that it's a level of coordination above that. It's where you can, through language, you can talk about the coordinations that of your body. Do you see? So it's a higher level form of coordination that then feeds back down to the actual levels of what we do. And look at us now, but I mean, I'm reminded of university, all of education. What on earth are we doing? Well, eventually, all of this recursive talking together, it's supposed to feed back into your actual life. Yes. And even if it, we're at quite a high level with language, talking about language. But do you see how it works on a building site? If you're just building a house, we use language to coordinate nearly everything that we do in the world. And so it's a higher level form of coordination that enables us to do things that we couldn't possibly do if we didn't have this ability to speak about things. So this is part of Maturana's view of language, of it being a coordination of coordinations. You see, there's it's a second level of coordination above our ordinary coordination, where our coordination of walking together. You know, I'm thinking just if you just hold hands with someone and start walking, you start getting in phase. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole level of how our bodies coordinate, naturally.
You talk better when you're walking. Like when the kids were smaller, we'd go anywhere and we were walking along. Then the conversation would flow and they'd jump ahead and they'd make up stories. And even then, I'd watch them through the window in the back garden and they'd be hopping around. And in order to make the story, they have to hop and walk up and down. And
it seems
to go together.
Yeah, and I mean, you were reading that in The Guardian, weren't you, Nicolette?
Yeah.
The whole thing about it's just so good for you to walk and talk.
Talking about walking and talking is very good because you use your walking, your physical, but you also, it triggers your whole
seems to set
talking,
you off, doesn't it?
Conversing together. And only recently a friend and I were walking and talking about how you kind of just chat a lot. Yeah, when you go to a coffee, but you do talk, but it's different when you're walking and flowing along. And
it's like the rhythm
along.
Of it somehow.
Yeah. It does. It.
Yeah.
And if you enjoy being together, then
So I'm going to get out of this slide. So we're getting down here. This the consensual does not refer to consent. It's the absence of stipulation, the absence of rules, the absence of one person putting an authority on another. This is Maturana's way of saying what I was trying to say. Coordination of behaviour happens without language throughout the biosphere. It is the recursion on coordination, that is the coordination of coordinations, which constitutes language. Does that come a bit clearer now? What he means here? And then he wants to say that language is the braiding of languaging and emotioning. I mean, this comes back to Heidegger as well, that we're always in a certain state, which you could say a certain state of attunement. He uses the word mood, but for me, I don't know if mood's the right word, you know, because when you say, oh, you're in a mood, it sort of has a different meaning in English, doesn't it? Oh, you're in a mood. It was so, when you're not in a mood, you're still in a certain kind of emotional attunement. Even when it's like now, you might say, well, you know, I don't feel anything in particular. Well, there's an attunement of interest, maybe. You know, and there's a certain feeling in just being interested. There's a certain feeling in just being alert. And your voice is continuously communicating the attunement that you're in. You know, as soon as somebody gets upset, have you ever, when somebody's angry suddenly, and you weren't expecting it, do you know? It's like an electric shock, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the language, isn't it? It's in the intonation of the voice. Quite an extraordinary energy comes out, and sometimes.
Depende people. Is this people get shouting or the people reaction differently in a speak or in attitude?
Yes, but it can even be in just a intonation of a particular word can really hurt.
Yeah.
Do you know how we can how we can slice someone?
Yeah.
I mean, it's
the words themselves might not even be that nasty, but
yeah.
The way we do it,
yes.
Just,
you're welcome.
Destroy it.
Yes.
It's like sweariness. I'm quite sweary, but I don't think it's particularly aggressive, but sometimes we'll hear people going down our road and they're angry and they're drunk and they're out and fuck's sake, and it's really much more scary than just... We were always swearing.
Yeah, yeah. You're reminding me of when we were living in Brighton near the Hand in Hand.
Yeah, it's,
staggering down the street. Yes.
Sometimes it's jolly and sometimes it wasn't.
Yeah.
Yes. Because we get, particularly at university, you know, you think that there's just this sort of abstract stream of language that has no feeling in it whatsoever, but it always does. You know, the tone of your voice is utterly attuned to your inner state. Even if your inner state is one of hiding it, of trying to hide what's going on in you, it's there.
Yeah, you can't really hide anything
from
you.
And something in us all is always reading that.
Well, I find it much nicer and more pleasant and a better experience when people are communicating what they're actually feeling, which I have to say, in this culture, doesn't happen an awful lot.
Well, that's being English is not communicating
exactly
what you're feeling. That's what we've made an art form of it.
If somebody's angry and they say to me, I'm really angry with you, you've really pissed me off, blah, 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 I stay calm, I'm fine with that. Okay, I'll listen to why they're angry with me. But if somebody is pretending that they're not angry with me, but they are angry with me, I feel the anger.
Yeah.
I feel what they're not expressing. I feel sadness that's unexpressed from other people. I feel anger that's unexpressed from other people. I feel fear that's unexpressed from other people. And I start to feel more and more uncomfortable. And I start saying things like, is there something wrong?
Yes.
And they deny it.
How many? £5, especially in reasonably close relationships. You okay? Yes, I'm fine.
I think in my language, you react with your feelings. So you express all your feelings, come off. And here the people in the I find, so for me it's unrealistic. Because they question me, see my word in this moment, no, it's fine. Why I say it's fine?
It's the culture.
Because in my culture, I know answer is why I say I'm not feeling well. I know realistic understand what happened in this moment in my life when too many problems.
I predicted
but
it, we got a chair for you.
But here it say fine, it's for me, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, my word, I don't pretend anything, I pretend nothing. It's hypocrite, you know? It's one hypocrite fair when myself in from the others. Why I need to find his reality, I don't find.
So,
so
we're on
I don't
a,
know,
we're
no,
on
no,
a big
no, I don't respect anything.
Yeah,
I understand
yeah,
this
no,
culture,
no,
this
I,
culture
I,
but my culture is
yes.
completely different.
Yes.
So, the dialectical language is completely different. Sorry.
I do have a, you know, there's something in me that might well come and defend the English in a while. But
well,
yeah,
no,
yes,
not
you,
much,
you,
Your Honor. Sorry.
Chilean.
Then that's true for him, but I'm looking at the braiding of language and emotion, and I'm thinking the English have managed to really split that off.
I
don't braid language
and
emotion.
I just wonder if in this country a lot is not said. So thinking about the elites and power relations, it's very subtle in the way that put downs are done.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke about hierarchy last week, but you can see it in familial lines. I wouldn't want to be in the royal family at the moment, if ever. But what I mean by that is that you've got characters there who have been regimented into a certain way of being, and it's often the love has been taken out of their upbringing, probably by the public school system, and how they're inculcated in that, and that this could be part of what some people say the English are aloof or reserved or not expressing emotion. It's almost then it can be trumped. It's almost like they can show their power, as if to say, well, you know, and often in this country, reference is made to I've got French family, so, you know, as being perhaps more demonstrative, expressing themselves with their hands or through their voice. There's a Britishness which is almost like, are the ice cold?
There's a reason to that.
Well,
you'll
probably express it better. It's what I've just observed, though, through my life. It's a way of actually dominating. Well, that's how I've expressed it, and that's how I've lived it.
It's positive and negative, because the people domination has said, but el reserve, every moment el reserve, no es good for your heart, a finish, in the spiritual way. Yes? It's really... I don't know.
I already feel, we're opening something up here. It's quite significant, but it's not part of... what we're dealing with today.
I just want to say this about like expressing with the hands. It's in Italy, in France, or other places in Europe. The societies there are not as old as English. English society is one of the oldest, closed societies in the world. And in other societies, people didn't understand each other, so they have to explain with their hands. But here, English, like it's so old, 1,000-year-old, maybe more than 1,000. So there was a agreed language, so there wasn't a need to express with your hands.
Is it not that actually there's loads of different strings of language that made up the English language not that long ago?
Yeah, that's
right. So it's actually not a very old language at all.
Mm.
It's what's it, Anglo-Saxon? What else is
there's
it?
Some German, isn't there? There's a bit French and there's some
the English,
words.
The current English is not...
It's not old.
You mean the culture? Though
it's a mixture.
The culture is the oldest.
But the language isn't, so then the whole gesticulating doesn't, you know, you would need it even more so.
Anyway, look, can I pull us back from, although I did want to say for the English, on behalf of the English, if you're English and you know what it is to be English and you know how to communicate as an English person, it's another kind of game. And one aspect of the game is to communicate what you mean by saying what you don't mean. That's just something that's grown up.
It's a real art form.
Yeah.
It really is.
And if you love someone and you know what you're doing, it's very enjoyable. Yeah, but it's not such a good way to get on I guess the other thing I wanted to say, just in relation to this expression of emotion, also on behalf of the English, is that I get, and this is on behalf of me really, there are only a few people that I love, really love. And there's something about the way that we use language, and the Romance languages are the same with tu and vu in French, and I think German has the same. You have a language for your intimates and a language for the rest, yes? And that got destroyed in English, right? The I, thou was destroyed, so everyone's a you for us. But it remains. It remains in a sense that you keep all the yous away, and you still have a. Do you see? There's a English people keep people at a distance, but that doesn't mean there isn't an intimate circle. Do you know? In one way or another, when you talk about being hypocritical. There's a level here where I'm English, right? I'm not open with everyone. I would be a fool to be open with everyone. I'm being a fool now, actually.
So who's open then?
Yes, but that's what I mean. So we all, in one way or another, dissimulate.
Yes.
Yeah, just we have different ways of doing it.
Yes, that's true. Because my coach has put open, but it's possible open in one moment, but in another, no.
Yeah. The English is just quite subtle in the way that it does things. I think in a way you need to be English to read it properly, fully.
There's a great book, Watching the English, by... Kate Fox or Anna Fox, an anthropologist, and she really takes apart all the funny ways the English are, but with a lot of respect and love, because she's English herself, and she just, watched the English for years and years, and just the things like the queuing system, the football, their particular way of enjoying football, and yeah, it was really beautiful, actually. But, saying about the emotions, and it being a culture where expressing feelings is not such a thing. I'm a counselor and I have people come through the door and they're struggling because they've never learned to express how they feel. And they're really detached from their feelings.
Do you notice similarity between the English and the Japanese?
I don't know about the Japanese, but definitely the English and the Germans. But I don't know about the Japanese.
The culture, the Indian, the Pakistan people.
Yeah.
Express the feeling, the other for completely different, and analyze situation que for the normal people or the Occident people, or the East people or the West or the Europa is completely different. So the people, I the India, looking people, the India and the Pakistan, it's important the details. The details que no es important for the other culture, for these people is important. So if
very.
You know anything.
It's very
can I pull us back, please?
Sorry.
Yes, yeah. So I was bad. I shouldn't have said anything about being English. So it's at the bottom here. Maturana is seeing language as a form of doing. It's an activity. It's a behaviour that involves the nervous system, He's quite clear about this. We tend to understand it as something happening somewhere else, and he's trying to bring it back and say no, it's a form of behaviour, and it's a form. But McGilchrist is going to say that, if we get to it, that it's one way that it's being thought of by anthropologists is an extension of grooming. It's like we're touching someone when we speak to them. But language gives us the ability to touch someone at a distance and to touch many people at once. But it's an extension of a tactile communication through the dimension of sound. But we go off in the meaning of the words and we often lose touch with the physicality of it, of what's going on, but it's still going on. There's still always a this. We'll talk more about the body later. Yes, that first sense structure is language just occurs in consensuality is a bit of a repetition. So operations, this is the second paragraph, such as declarations, statements, expressions, promises or requests, which is the staple food of standard philosophy of language, analysing what they are and how they differ, which is, you might see, we're not doing that. As well as orientations such as purposes, intentions or desires, are all secondary operations in languaging. This is more Maturana telling us what he thinks languaging is. It's a behaviour, that's why he's using it as a verb. We can distinguish them as such as we reflect on what we do once we are already living in language. Thus they are not primary constitutive elements of language. So our understanding of what language, and I guess this is important for both Maturana and McGilchrist, they're not actually saying what language is. I don't know if you noticed that. There's a sort of a going around it. They're not going, right, what is language? So what exactly is language?
Because it's mysterious.
Yes. If anyone's starting to feel that, I guess I should. I'm saying, well, Heidegger. Heidegger's in a way going to try and take us into language. Where at the moment we're still round the edge, looking at the origins of it, and we're looking at one of different ways that people have looked at it, without really going into it. So I would say Maturana, and neither Maturana nor McGilchrist have really gone into it, but they're going into the behaviours that may or may not have happened in the past. If I can remind you again why this isn't just a theory, what Maturana is saying is meaningful to me because it communicates to something in me that responds to it. And I think that's the most you can get out of something like this, which is, as I said last week, it's a kind of a myth. And one of the reasons that I'm going into it is because it's in a way, I'm hoping it's highlighting the myth of our culture. The myth of our culture in the background, not that you're necessarily taught it explicitly, but in the way that we behave, is the myth of Darwin. It's the myth of man, the tool-making, dominant species. Man with a capital M, but it used to be just man. The male of the species. Made axes, tools, and axes. And develop language, and they're all part of this emergence of this sort of super dominant, most successful species on Earth story. That's our why is that our myth? Really, because we don't have a myth. It's essentially our Christian myth was destroyed. And so what we're left with is just, we're left with our science because we don't have anything else. It's not really a myth in the sense of something that a people has worked out as a story of where we came from. We're the first culture to actually think that we can get by saying, well, we don't really have a story of where we came from, except evolution. That's the best we've got. An evolution as a story is it's a myth by default, if you see what I mean. how can I put it? Nobody. What emerges from evolution, this story of a kind of mindless survival of the fittest, it's not a myth that somebody said, "Oh, let's create a myth of the blind watchmaker of the mindless progress of evolution." It fell out of the way that we do science. The way that we do science is, as we said, well, we're only going to accept as real what we can measure, what's objective. And as soon as we only accept as real what we can measure and what is objective, then the entire reality of our own consciousness is not exactly dismissed, but it just doesn't show up in that view of things. Then you take that view of things, and you get something like evolution.
There is something that my brother told me about, the fact that as humans, as a species, if we, you know, if we emerge in Africa where food is around, pretty much, you know, you grab your hand and you can get it. But as we moved, spread it into other climates where food is a bit more scarce, so that, first of all, the level of coordination that's required for the daily life and the level of planning and thinking and, you know, building a house that can withstand
the weather
and arrange for food to be available, because you no longer can just go and take a banana off the tree. So that dictates how we behave in, you know, that does require. And this can explain why Western culture or European culture has become what it became, because it needed to deal with harsher weathers, where if we stayed in Africa, maybe we could have remained in this more loving society that can be created, where the individual feels secure that they would have food tomorrow and the next day. They're not like we feel, if I stop working, eventually I fail on my mortgage payments, I will get evicted, I will get in the street, you know, blah,
yes,
blah, blah, blah. That's the natural thing. I have to, you know, I feel threatened. In my daily life, I feel threatened, you know. If I'm old and I haven't got a pension, you know, what will happen to me? You know, maybe I'm self-employed, maybe there won't be clients and I will end up in the street. It's always like this, end up in the street.
Yes.
As a ultimate kind of fear.
And of course, and in Brighton, right in front of your eyes, isn't it?
I mean, for me, it's like, if I don't end up in the street, I feel like I've managed it.
Yeah,
life,
I've succeeded.
Like, you know,
succeed. Yes.
But if I was, you know, if this is like the universal basic, the income is meant to resolve for people this kind of state of being in constant fear. And we're only in constant fear because of the species we move from where we're most suitable to be living into a harsh condition.
Can I just go on from that?
No.
Just one sentence.
One sentence, yes, yes.
But that presumes that there is a scarcity of resources in the world, and we know that there isn't.
There is a scarcity. Right now, I don't have a...
No, it was going to be one sentence.
And I said it.
Can we... Yeah. I definitely do, because do you see, in each... I know it's cruel, but we keep opening up subjects that we can't
yeah,
fully examine. You see, and it's very rare, I find this all the time, that a group of people ever fully examines anything, because,
yeah,
you know. So we're just back with Maturana's understanding of language, and saying that the level of language that we have now is secondary, and has come about as a result of our ability to reflect. And this ability to reflect, I think Maturana and McGilchrist are going to say, and I think I could agree, that language itself doesn't necessarily mean reflection. You can. I think language will have come first as a coordination of behaviour, which didn't mean you being abstracting yourself from you. It would just be a matter of speaking and doing. The level where we're on now, where we're reflecting on language, came later. It was another sort of capacity of language, if you like, that partly McGilchrist is going to talk about more than Maturana. Maturana's interested in this birth of language much earlier than the kind of language that we use now, that we are using now. So the last paragraph, particular configurations of sounds, gestures or marks that we call words, again, this is his systems thinking, are operational nodes in the network of consensual coordinations of behaviours. I've lost myself now. That we live as languaging beings. So I don't know if you can get the perspective. He's trying to look at the form, the actual structure of the behaviour of languaging beings. And instead of words being things that are subjectively in us, he's saying they're actual nodes that are part of the way that we organise our coordination of behaviour. If you were to look... I mean, he's almost a behaviorist. He's saying, he's not saying this, but in a way, one way to understand it, take your entire consciousness out of this and just look at what language does, and how the words that I'm using and that we use in life affect the behavior of the people around us, and you'll start to see that the actual words and the phrases and the sentences that we use are kind of structures that are almost external to us, that are having effects on other people. Because we tend to think that there's an objective world and a subjective world, and language somehow is in the subjective world, and the objective world is separate. And Maturana's view is he's in some way wants to say no, let's see it as all one thing, and see how our language is actually part of this structure of our lives. Remembering, if you remember last week, we talked about autopoiesis, and because we tend to think that the structure of our lives is the material structures, not the processes that we live, and the a living cell is only a cell insofar as the process of life is going on in it. It's not the material. The living cell is a process with a certain structure and a certain organisation. Do you see his thinking is, and so is language. It's a higher level process with a higher level form, but it's like the cell. It's just at a much higher level, and it's emerged. And emergence is one of the concepts of systems. You know, multicellular life emerged out of single cellular life, and then complex bodies with different organs emerged out of multicellular life, and then nervous systems emerged out of complex bodies, and nervous systems represent an even higher level of organisation than a simple body, because the nervous system, in a sense, controls the body. And then the nervous system starts to produce language. Do you see that a language emerges out of the nervous system? They're all forms of organisation in increasing levels, built on the lower level. And they're all continuously and seamlessly connected with everything else. See, I'm just trying to give you a flavour of thinking of language as a behaviour. Yes.
I'm having trouble understanding this last bit.
he doesn't about words.
Yes.
He doesn't mean then that the meaning of words is something that emerges as the result of our conversations, or that context is what shapes the meaning of the words.
Well, it's not explicit on this, but my picture of it is something like this. We'll start with a simple naming of something. You know, to start with, we might be singing along, and we have a certain sound that then indicates another person or a tree, a particular tree, we're trying to say, well, what's the meaning of the word is somehow it evokes the tree in you, and it evokes the tree in me, and it's in a certain sense it's the tree in another form. Yes, we've taken the tree now, and we've got another form of the tree, which is a sound that we can emit and that we can recognize, and as a result of that we can then do more than we could otherwise, especially when the tree isn't there. Do you see, we can coordinate our behavior around things that aren't present because we can make them present in sound. Yes. So what meaning is a deep question that we aren't even going into here, but because meaning for us is, you know, I think you remember this from before, meaning is a word like the ocean for a fish. Do you know, we just live in meaning. So how do you get hold of meaning and say this is meaning? Because I'm using meaning. It's like language itself. I'm using meaning to talk about meaning. But we can talk about words in terms of that they have forms, and those forms have effects on our behaviour. So does that's not a full answer, Maria, but it's...
It just says the meaning of a word takes place. The meaning of the word takes place. That suggests to me that the meaning of a word is something that emerges. It happens. Yeah? It happens in the flow of coordinations of behaviour.
Which it participates as an element.
As an element of conversation, the flow of consensual coordination and coordination. He's already defined
yes.
that as conversation.
Yes.
But
a conversation is a behaviour. Everything here is a form of behaviour.
It doesn't have to be with another person.
Well, in what way would a word be effective?
Well, people write stuff all the time on their own, don't they?
Yes. But then, we aren't talking about writing yet.
Speaking it, I talk to myself all the time.
Yes.
At home.
And also the words that you can think in your mind will have effect on your emotional
yeah.
state.
Yes,
that's true. Yes.
So it's not a conversation, it could be a conversation with yourself.
Yes.
Sometimes you see conversation between sisters or family members, you notice there's not any subject matter, they're just like, so there's no... It's coordination of coordination.
I'm just saying that conversation isn't something that has to happen between two separate people.
It has to come into being initially through two separate people. And in a way, if you're writing, you're imagining another you. You're talking to you, but you're also listening to you. So you're making a conversation with two people in your own head, or however many people.
So
it has to come from
the conscience.
You will have no conversation if you've got no other people. And how would your thought processes be if you never had any other people?
So can I hold it back just a little bit? Because we're moving into an area which is to do with reflection. So when you're engaging with conversation with yourself, you're engaging in a form of reflection. And I'm not sure... this whole question of when did the human race start reflecting is different to the question of when did we start languaging. I think reflecting came later.
Well, that conversation with God.
I mean, sometimes when I'm on my own, I'm just sort of speaking the words of a poem or a song. I'm not reflecting on anything. I'm just babbling away to myself.
But
if somebody stopped me and said, oh, you've just said the word wallpaper, what does that mean? I'd know the meaning of the word.
But you're using the model of the conversation that would take place between two or more people, and that's already happened, and now you're using the model to have a conversation with yourself.
But I'm not reflecting.
I'm not saying you are reflecting, but I'm saying where that is, and sort of hierarchy of...
My behaviour is just, in this particular hypothetical occasion, is just babbling away to myself, probably while I'm doing something else, and I'm not really aware of what I'm saying. I might be just reciting something.
Like the sounds and the rhythms.
And I'm not... But if somebody stopped me and said, what does that word mean? I'd know the meaning.
So at this point... I'm trying to, you know, interpret Maturana where he hasn't made himself clear.
Yes.
But so you're just hearing my interpretation, and my interpretation is, I think, inner conversations came later.
And also,
it's to do with what reflection means. It's my opinion. So that our talking to ourselves came along with our ability to reflect. You're saying it's not reflecting.
Well, babies, young children talk to themselves all the time.
They babble away to themselves. But that's like, it's like an involuntary, if you talk to yourself, if you're not consciously thinking about the subject, like I can sit and think about the subject, or if I was talking to myself, if it's an involuntary action that the brain is generating, then yeah, like I say, you would know the words, but the reason why you know the words is because those words that you were just involuntarily saying, they originate in some sort of conversation that you had before where you learned the meaning of the word in that conversation. Now the fact that you're doing it involuntarily, is that not what gave the word wallpaper? If you just said wallpaper involuntary, that's not why wallpaper is wallpaper. Wallpaper is wallpaper because in conversation with other people, it's been agreed that wallpaper represents paper.
But what we're talking here is with Maturana, is we're talking way back, pre-Homo sapien.
Yeah, they didn't have a clear idea of subject and object.
And it's not at all clear. What state of? I don't think we would recognise that state of consciousness. That
he says we live. He doesn't mean we in the present moment. He means people 3 million years ago.
Yes.
So do you think monkeys have legs?
No, I don't. Well, I do. I don't think. I think there's something happened with the human race much more recently than Maturana's talking of, that changed, that made us self-conscious rather than just conscious. So reflection maybe is the wrong word. So because you're thinking reflection has a certain it's a certain state that you're in, and then you're not reflecting.
I see where I'm getting confused. Well, you said language does not necessarily entail reflection. Initially, there was just speaking and doing, and reflection came later.
Yes.
I thought you meant in our own lifetime.
No.
Right.
Surely, as soon as you have words to represent meaning that you can share with other people, you can use those words out of context in the form of a story, and that's kind of reflecting because it's a thing that isn't there that you're talking about. Like
yes.
You've got the word for tree and rock and cat and you're in your cave or your dwelling. And surely as soon as you have the words, there's the possibility of using them out of context and then building something imaginary. And is that reflection?
Yes. Well, See, we're talking about things that they're taking us beyond what Maturana's speaking of, and into a realm of conjecture as well. It's very hard to piece all this together. So certainly, you know, that in the sort of mainstream science, the thinking is, you know, Homo sapiens, 100,000 years ago, something like that. We started becoming clearly who we are, and it was about 40,000 years ago that the cave arts started, maybe earlier. And the general sense is that something happened then. The language as we understand it is only recent in that sense. And the idea that we got the idea that we could make images of things on cave walls is generally considered to be, that seems to be related to language, that we're now representing things to ourselves. Now Maturana is saying that this form of languaging that he's talking about started to occur 3 million years ago in other species, not just us. So he's looking back into the deep past here, to something that he means language in a different way to the way that we have it now, although he is talking about how we have it now as well. And he's not making that distinction. But I'm just adding it, if you like. I'm adding a distinction that clearly, well, we haven't got there yet, have we? Our Australopithecus afarensis. That's who. That's who. I'm making it up anyway. I don't know what the proper. That's the ancestor he wants to go back to, who started, for whom languaging really would have been just a sheer behaviour, if you like, something emerging from a state of being that we're not in touch with. But Maturana isn't looking at what was the subjective experience. He's just looking at the coordinations of behaviour. What I'm trying to say here is that in his view of things, taking the subjectivity away and what meaning means to us, he's just looking at the structure of the behaviours that language facilitates.
The evolution of the language. The evolution.
Yes.
There's one thing. The language that we speak is a state language, is not a small community's language. You can't, maybe nowadays in this time, it's very hard to find a language that is developed by people, not just by the state. The language that we use is modified and it's completely changed in order to fit the intention of the state that we live in, whether France, whether England. If you want to see a language that is purely, pure language, you can, I think maybe Mongolia, maybe old Turkish, Kaba Turkish is called, Amazon,
yeah.
Definitely.
But there's a lot of, I mean,
there's a
you have to be born into that language, don't you?
Yeah.
And so it's for us, it's too late.
Yes, it's too late. Yeah.
What sort of behaviours would language facilitate? Because I'm thinking that if it doesn't, in a state where there's no reflection, and you can't make a sound for something that isn't actually there, then you don't need language, do you? So if I'm sitting with me group of hominids,
yes,
I feel a bit cold. I put more wood on the fire. I don't need to talk about it, do I? I just behave. Why would being able to say?
I'm Lamanila, Lamanila. That's me. I'm just going to get some wood. Oh, okay, you know.
All right, so I
have an intention in me to get someone.
So I can talk about stuff that isn't there.
No, I just the very movement of me feeling to go and get some wood has a sound that I express, and now everybody knows that I'm going to get some wood. Previously, without the language, everybody would have known I just stood up.
Yes, for the reason that people say intentions.
Yeah. So you can start. You can start to express your inner.
It's an intention.
Yeah. Well, it's a secondary thing to have divided it up like that. You're gonna make sounds as you do things, mm-hmm. Yes. And as language develops, you get more refined in terms of. I'm just giving you an example. You're saying, well, how would it make a difference? That there, it would make it a difference there. You'd be able to, and I can sort of see that you could start to. You could start to express in sound your more about your inner state. As McGilchrist is going to say, you could start singing your inner state. And what happens, and we can all do that anyway, but what happens in the coordination of coordination is that our singing becomes coordinated, so that we start to sing the same song to refer to the same things.
I was always wondering about that. At what point does a spoon become a spoon? You know, so I was always curious. You know, at some point there must have been an object or an activity, mm-hmm. and people must have agreed somehow, and perhaps without so and so many words, to say, let's make this the table. Then, you know, how did they all make sort of a noise for a table, and then the other guy did the same noise, or
slang, you can catch it with slang, can't you? With when a new phrase develops in slang, somebody somewhere comes up with it, and somebody else hears it, and the person who came up with it, there's a faint sense of admiration. For the person who came up with it is somebody. It's not just some little kid, but oh yeah, no, that's a good way of saying it. You know, you got to get a feeling that says something that I couldn't say with another word. Do you know that's a pretty good word, and it sticks with you, right? And
he's a good example of that.
Yes.
So that recently, I heard someone on Radio 4 say using the term or the phrase "big enough." And I thought, when did that enter into, you know,
yes.
Speaking up, meaning
yes.
making yourself, you know,
yes.
big, bigger
yes.
than you are.
And
it's getting into real common use now, because, you know, presenters are, you know, well-respected Andrew Marr, people like
yes.
that are saying, bigging up. And I'm thinking, so that is how it happens.
Yes. And as I get older, I recognise, as you get older, I'm resistant to the language being added to. Do you know, I feel there are some perfectly good words to say that, thank you. And I really don't like the way that it's being changed. You know, there's a sort of a conservatism as you get in, because you kind of get a more fixed in your language, whereas when you're young, you want to kind of grab things from wherever. But I mean,
younger generation come in with like words, and it's like, oh, what?
But I've
heard
teachers,
later on you find
yes.
out what it means, and you think, oh, okay, I heard that yeah.
the other day. Teachers are saying they can't really understand what their students are speaking
right.
because they seem to be speaking a totally different language.
Well, isn't that a good
yeah,
thing
social
in a way?
Media. Yeah.
Because it's the same with text language, it's
yeah,
an evolution. It's a different expression. And going back to this idea about the state, in France there'd be seven or eight languages, so there'd be Alsacian, there'd be Breton, there'd be Occitan. But those words, they can become hybrid. The French use the term le week-end. And it's it's the fact that language can evolve and change which makes it so rich. So French Canadians, they borrow from Amerindian, they borrow from English. Does it mean that it's any less French to a purist? To perhaps a conservative conservateur? They would say yes. But if it conveys something that's of relevance to those that are in the street, then that is the ready acceptation that something's okay. It's when people in very high places and high writers say, well, no, I'm the arbiter of this, and I don't agree. So you can't say to, you've got to say who. You can't construct your sentence that way, but in actual fact, if you are a bit more flexible, then you can.
Yes, but it's partly coming back to what Alex is saying about a state language. You know, if you want to organise a state, you know, with millions of people in it, you need a common language.
Yeah.
As well. So there's that's just the word. That's emerged of itself anyway. You know, there'll be a meta language that comes through the media. You know, the media's the form that coordinates the nation. And wherever you want to coordinate people, you have to have an agreed language. Otherwise,
it slides around all the time as well, depending on the context that the word's used in. Because some words suddenly become... everything seemed to be robust according to government spokespersons a while back, or the council, or whatever. We have a robust system in place. And as though things were made robust by just using this word, then... And now it sounds like a sneaky word to me, and not like things are moving all the time.
Yes, there's a whole area there about what's happening to language, mm-hmm. in the public realm. So it's becoming the art of deception is becoming a science. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what's happening. So the public discourse has been systematically and deliberately subverted.
George Monbiot did an article of that a few weeks ago about how governments are all learning the same model with a fool that people won't take seriously, and it's happening. And there's actually people are recording, people know how to do it now, like getting Bojo in and getting Trump in and getting Bolsonaro in. It's the same pattern that is being learned and misinforming people.
Yeah. And how to control the subconscious perception of things by using the right language and controlling the narrative that's behind the context of the narrative, as long as you can control the language in the right... It's terrible. Terrible to watch.
Yes.
Terrible. Which we won't go into that. So the recursive dynamics... this is just a little bit more on recursion... talking about walking, about how walking is essentially recursive behaviour. It's the same over and over and over and over. And yet, as soon as the body gets the idea, you're able to translate yourself across the earth, yes, through this recursive movement. And this, of course, is a tremendous discovery of the species. Look at how many animals walk. None of them have wheels. That's not because they're stupid. It's because you have to build roads if you've got wheels. Legs are the way to go. Oh, look, I've got some. Anyway, let's see. I've already got them. Yeah. And again, you see, it's giving you Maturana's view. The recursion of walking is like the recursion of language. We're recursively talking, and yet it's the engine of our progress as a civilization. It isn't just going in a circular fashion. It enables us to coordinate our mutual behaviours. Even if it is, I'm just going to get some wood. It could be, would you like to come with me? You know, it's the beginning of a... You see what it opens up. It opens up the possibility of complex interactions between people that wouldn't be possible otherwise. And that's how Maturana's seeing it. And the last, just going to the last sentence, languaging constitutes an expanding field of open-ended possibilities for the recursive generation of new manners of living together. He's a kind of he's almost a mathematician in a way. Do you see? He sees as soon as we've got something like language, the possibilities for the ways that we can behave suddenly exponentially expand in relation to not having language. It's just an opening up of what at the beginning of the class we were calling the unnatural world. But of course, in a way, it is natural, right? It's a natural outpouring of a nervous system like ours. God could see it. You know, I don't mean God. I mean, if there were any intelligence like we imagine we are that was looking down, as soon as you see a brain like that, you could say, well, if we just make it a bit bigger, we're going to get something like language. So this is Maturana's story. So I wanted to make it reasonably clear so that we can contrast it, if you like, later with what McGilchrist has to say. So he's looking back, but his story is that we've got something like a chimp body 3 million years ago. How did we get to here? Yes, because if you look at the rest of the great apes and the chimps, they've remained reasonably similar to each other over that period of time, and something shot out in an evolutionary sense. Something shot out of the lineage of the great apes. It's us, and he's so when he's looking at language, he's not looking at 40,000 years ago in cave paintings. He's saying, in order for us to have developed the larynx, the tongue, the ability to actually articulate the way that we do, would have taken a long time. And he's figuring probably about 3 million years. So he's reasoned back. How long would it have taken to have produced? Because he's basically saying, just look at us. We are languaging beings, and if you remember from last week, he's saying we're languaging beings because we were, for a long period of time, at least in our families, loving beings, and that something like language could only emerge from an environment of play and trust and love. And we're going to, I think, there's a few slides that's going to go over that again. This is part of an argument he's presenting, and part of that is saying, to get to this, I mean, after reading Maturana, I remember I was going through the supermarket and I was seeing, I just seeing the human body all over again. Despite everything, we are the gentle apes. You know, the tender apes with our fine fingers, our little smooth skins, our little eyelashes. I mean, we're beautiful. We're beautiful things. We really are. And like we were saying last time, and in fact, we are like little babies. We are. Our little smooth skins and...
Another just one sentence. The herb on the radio this morning, just talk about nursing. And they're talking about the power of touch and how just the act of actually resting your hand on, say, a patient, and how that necessarily affects them and calms them down before an operation.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that. Just the power of the human species is overwhelming.
Yeah.
In terms of that gentle ape-ness.
Yeah, yeah. No, it doesn't take much.
Yeah.
You're on one of them operating trolleys, and somebody's not cruel to you. They show some kind of understanding of how you're feeling. It's tremendous.
But how do we know that animals don't experience the same?
They do. Baboons, they tap on the back.
The gist of it being that all of the mammals have this capacity. It's we didn't invent it. We just expanded it into adulthood, and into a. Are you getting the feeling now? I'm looking at Alex. I'm thinking, I can see the lineage of what how incredible it is that we went. I mean, that's just a reconstruction, right? But do you see? Can you see
can
like
we
a fast like a fast forward movie? Do you see that the jaw? Everything had to change with the jaw, the throat, the uprights. Yes. And not just that, you know what we were talking about last week in relation to the expansion of female sexuality. Do you know what happened to the bodies? You know, I can almost feel that our loss of hair was to do with how much we enjoy being touched. Do you know that loss of hair is because it's so beautiful just to feel the sensitivity of the skin. Well, because we're a bit brutish, aren't we? We're not quite. It's obvious, isn't it? It's obvious. We like to do the touching, you know.
I thought the loss of hair. This is obviously very recent. This isn't 3 million years ago.
Yeah.
Was it the advent? Since the advent of clothes, we've just become less hairy. I mean.
But then why do we still? Why do we women still get hair on the legs? You know, surely they could have.
Yeah, you didn't touch them there.
Exactly, we need to touch the legs more. Why does evolution stop? You know, why did the evolution stop? I don't understand.
No,
okay, less and less hair, but then it's like we're still having those hair.
But why male
hair?
Why
do
we have hair?
That's, I guess, yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Why should everything
have
hair?
You don't need it anymore. A little bit.
I think it was a choice of partners. If females found less hairy men somehow more attractive, then that would yield generation after generation of less hairy
kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. There you have it. And the it was a natural selection. But why did we find less hair more beautiful? Because we like to touch each other.
And there's more babies.
It's a good reason.
And there's more babies.
Yeah.
Because if baby, even in the young, animals are less hairy, they become more hairy. So a male or a female that exhibit less hair would still evoke the emotion of this mother baby kind of. Closeness.
You do see that it's obvious in that sense that we through a long period of time we have selected for what we find more beautiful because that's the way the mating works, isn't it?
Well, the hairy Aino would beg to differ. They're a very hairy tribe.
Yes. Yeah. No. There's no fixed. There's no fixed thing. No, it's not. All of this reasoning hasn't come out of there was some innate something, right? It's to do with choices that were made and then conserved. It's the whole story is the conservation of behaviours. You see, and if you start conserving a behaviour becomes a kind of a culture that finds less hair more attractive. It's self-perpetuating through the generations. It doesn't mean that less hair is more attractive, but I quite like my own. There was a dog in the cafe the other day, and who hardly very thin hair, and that's probably what informed me. Because suddenly there's a whole level of intimacy. You know, it was in fact it was getting. I was getting a bit uncomfortable. I think I'm getting a bit too close to this dog. You know, because it's more like touching a human as soon as There's a, with the less hair.
It's like baby puppies, and their tummies are all naked.
Yeah.
It's like a little human belly.
Yeah.
It's like, and it's their vulnerability.
Yes. Are you with the last week's, because with last week's lecture we were talking about neonteny, and how the childhood features of human babies and children, what happened in evolution is we retained them, we stopped maturing, we stayed in a state of childhood into adulthood, and that the reasoning behind that was partly to do with that we started to enjoy making love, that was part of the playfulness of the intimacy of the mother-child relationship started to be expanded and expanded into adulthood and expanded into the...
Don't bonobos like all that stuff, though? I mean, bonobos are not... They're more like chimps than us, and they spend an inordinate amount of time fiddling about with each other.
They do indeed, yes.
So
yeah,
how
yeah.
does that...
Well, we have to kind of... I was wondering about the bonobos myself, about how long ago they started to develop this form of behaviour. That would be the question. Because if they started to develop this 3 million years ago, you would have expected them to have started to evolve like us. So I suspect, and this is very hard to demonstrate, that it's... we were talking about it, weren't we? It was to do with partly they were separated by the Congo from the chimp population, but they haven't evolved like us. So that you may well have a counter argument, right, with the bonobos. So if this is true, then what about the bonobos? Would be a good question.
What are they? I don't even know what they are.
They're a kind of chimp they've learnt to. I mean, one aspect of it is they've learned to diffuse aggressive behaviour through sexual contact.
All right.
That's so the boys with boys, girls with girls, no fixed, you know, not so the you know people and the female bonobos, they're not exactly they've got a much greater status in the troop, is it?
Hierarchy.
Yeah. But there's much less of a hierarchy. It's all share and share alike. There's a sort of an idyllic view of the bonobos. I started to look at them because they come up in relation to this.
I think because they didn't invent fire, discover fire.
Yeah, but that's the old patriarchal thing, isn't it? That's the old man, the tool maker, isn't it? But I guess the answer to the question is I don't know. And I'm not sure that anyone's really said, well, you know, taken Maturana seriously enough to try and refute him. But that's, yes.
Related to the number of children we can have that are still children at different ages and we all have to cooperate. And, you know, you don't have one baby and raise it and then have another baby and raise it. You have the cooperation between needing help from the older children.
Yes.
I don't know where I'm going.
Maybe. Yes.
But then that's what you're talking about, extension of childhood as well.
Yes.
Extended.
And another answer to Maria is an awful lot of this is adventitious. Like a tribe stumbles upon a certain form of behaviour and then passes it on. And it, they may not have done. Do you know it's not there's no inevitability in this. It can easily be some chance discovery of one individual in one place in Africa starts a certain behaviour off that then gets passed on and then gets embedded and then one thing leads to the next that leads to the next, and it could all have not happened. Do you know there's no inevitability in it either, like life itself.
Yeah.
The whole thing has got this kind of enormous aspect of chance in it, or has it? You know, it depends. Or has it? We don't know actually whether that's our Darwinian view, of course, that it was all done by chance. There are many ways that we could question that as well. So here we are. And it's remembering again, Maturana, this is just a proposal he's making. So languaging wasn't necessary or in any way advantageous, but was just something that grew up as from living together, and through enjoying being together, and through playing. It's an extension of something that was pleasurable to begin with. And of course, it doesn't mean that there wasn't anger and quarrelling and mistrust, but the basic thesis is that couldn't have been the primary mood, because in an environment like that, language couldn't have sustained itself, because it needed to sustain itself in a stable environment for hundreds of generations, if not thousands. So it needed a stable state of cooperation amongst the people who were playing together. So, which is what he's saying, a space of intimate and stable cooperative existence. He's basically saying that's for something like language to have emerged. This is all evolution does. This it's a reasoning back. Then something like this. Not must have been the case. It seems like it was probable. It was the case. All right. There's a theory of evolution here. Of genetic drift, which is I touched on last week, but it's important to this whole argument, which is that once a form of behaviour like languaging gets embedded in a species, then that's the way that they live, and that's the way that they interact with everything else. So that's the way that because the environment isn't fixed either. That will totally determine your mode of living and where you live and how you change the environment. And then as you change the environment, that changes the way you live. And we were talking about fire, right? The discovery of fire was, in fact, for Maturana, was a new way of interacting with the environment that utterly changed the environment. And then there may be new ways of hunting. Right. As soon as you find a new way of hunting, it utterly changes the balance between predator and prey, which just ripples through the whole ecosystem. So every change in behaviour, it's not like there's some fixed environment and you're trying to adapt to it. Every change in behaviour just ripples through and changes the entire environment that you're living in, especially for a species like us.
It was an idea. It was the invention of a fire. Discovering a fire was an idea, how to make a fire is
an idea. But for Maturana, it's a behaviour.
Yeah.
Yes, it's another behaviour that utterly transforms what's possible. It opens up a whole dimension of possibility. Now, what he's saying is that now you're living like that, it's a kind of, and you're reproducing it, which means you're just introducing the children to it and they pick it up too. You've got a kind of almost like he's calling it a canal, like a tunnel in which you live. And insofar as your genetic inheritance, which is the possibility for what your body can do, fits in with living in language, then you'll survive. If your genetic inheritance is such that you don't fit in with living in language, you don't communicate well, then you won't survive, or you're less likely. There's a survival differential. Do you see that the survival of the fittest is the idea about being eaten, or not getting enough food, or not getting any, no pension. Yeah, no mate. Do you see the way that you live starts to determine who's going to reproduce, but not in a survival of the fittest way. You start to get what's called genetic drift, which says, no, it's not that the fittest, the fastest running and all the rest of it are going to survive. It's the ones who can blend into this language and culture who are going to survive. And that produces a whole genetic drift, which means that all kinds of other genetic possibilities survive. And look at us, right? We in our culture, right? An enormous variety of genetic possibility now survives, which wouldn't have survived in a harsher environment. So he's saying that the process of evolution, as soon as languaging gets hold, as the central feature of our being together, is going to favour languaging. You're following? You're going to be more interested in people that, if you're a communicator, in people that you can communicate with and you can enjoy being with. Do you know the whole dynamic of why you would have children together starts to change? Of course, you're still interested in a guy who can throw a spear or whatever. Do you know that? It's not that doesn't count, but a whole other dynamic.
If you couldn't talk, yeah.
Yeah. Can't talk. Yes. I mean, it's not as simple as that, right? But we only need the differential changes, and we start to evolve as a culture. And not just us, but all the species are like this. They find a mode of living that they reproduce by passing it on to their children. And then the mode of living determines who survives. You see, the evolution is bigger than the kind of Darwinistic idea that you may or may not have already been inculcated with. I was certainly inculcated with it, so I'm more reactive towards, you know, when you've been convinced of something and then you realise, but it's not like that. You start to see that there's almost an ideology in Darwinism. That
when we expect to find at least some evidence of non-languaging ancestors of us. I'm sure you'd actually prove they were non-languaging.
Well, the,
because it seems quite extreme that that there are no non-languaging
there are no languaging, you mean no other languaging species?
No, I mean
so in the Maturana is saying that 3 million years ago we started to language because of the way our bodies evolved. There's no, we better be clear about this. There's no evidence. How could there be that we actually were languaging apart from his argument until very recently? So this we're talking, you know, maybe 2.9 million years. Of pure building up to Homo sapiens, cave paintings, tools, burials of the dead, obvious signs of us having developed some kind of reflective symbolic languaging. That the only evidence for that is very recent. The evidence that he's propounding is that in order for that to have occurred, it couldn't have happened like that. Our whole structure of our body, which is, you know, that quick picture is saying is that and I'll be talking about this later, that the tongue, you know, our whole ability to articulate sounds finally would have taken millions of years. Why would we have selected for that? I mean, there are people who say, because we're like birds. This is the Darwin. All right, I'll give you the Darwin story. We were like the birds, and we were more likely to mate if we could sing nicely. So it was just accidental. We were singing to each other, and it helped us to mate. And then suddenly there was language. You know, do you see the other stories? I mean, I'm giving it in a parody form, but he's trying to explain the shape of our body,
yeah.
Why it came to be what it is, and in a way, you see, the only the proof of it is
it's Gerda as well, John. You mustn't forget that Gerda's the other lady, that
yes.
Wrote.
Yes, I am forgetting.
Because it's not just Maturana, but
yes, it's true. It's Maturana's systems theory that yes, I think it's Verdun Zoller who brought the word love into biology here, because and the whole, she's a child psychologist, so it's her insight into love and children and upbringing and intimacy that I keep calling it Maturana is a kind of paternalistic recognition of the dominance of the male. Yeah. So Nicolette's quite right to point out the whole dimension of bringing love into this, which just wasn't there in Maturana's work until this book. If you look at everything he has to say about autopoiesis, which is what he's famous for, there's no mention of love in it whatsoever. So something happened in there, in their collaboration, that's completely changed his view, I think. I mean, I wasn't there, of the meaning of evolution. So yes, Nicolette, are you going to forgive me if I
yeah, no, I was yeah. just remembering. I remember myself that
yes.
actually, and you told me this that
yes,
it was her. She's a child psychologist. I don't know who she is, but she had a huge impact on this whole.
Yes. Yes, and it's strange in
a
way.
Some people might not have known that, but listening, they went in the last.
Yes. Yeah, and it deserves to be mentioned that Maturana is a great charismatic famous figure, and Gerda Verdun Zoller is still just a practicing child psychologist somewhere in Germany with no internet presence whatsoever. Yeah.
No.
So.
But she obviously really did.
Yes.
You
so it's one of those usual. Scenarios, you know, where the great man kind of carries the whole thing in a way. Yes.
Good that you honoured her with that.
Yeah, no, she just popped into the room. She just popped into my head. I thought, well, actually, we wouldn't make it forgetting that she had a huge. She was part of this whole book.
So coming back, do you get the bigger argument? And almost, I feel like you have to get the argument almost viscerally, in just looking at a human body, and maybe go and visit a zoo and have a look at a chimpanzee, and say, well, how on earth did that become this? It's very Goethe did this in relation to looking at plants and seeing how all of nature is in this continuous. There's a continuous connectivity between all of the forms of nature, and this there's a fascinating connectivity between us and the great apes, that you can see. I can intuitively start to feel it. You know, you can get into a mindset with it, and you start looking. And I can't help every time I do it. I can't help but think we're so beautiful. We're such beautiful apes.
That's what's so nice.
Yes.
About this,
yes. 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 Yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Maria.
Thank you.
So that if I can just go back to this idea of evolution, which is central to what he's talking about. There was nothing necessary about it, and to begin with, it had no advantage whatsoever. And things don't have to occur purely because they have some kind of advantage. The main thing is that they don't have a disadvantage. Right? If there was some disadvantage in languaging that meant that we were going to be eaten by predators, then obviously it wouldn't have happened. But it was sort of neutral. But yes.
So maybe this is part of the development of language to work out certain dangers, to go tiger, and if everybody knows what tiger is, that's very useful.
Yes.
So maybe that's
monkeys do that.
Yes, but that's right. There are definite calls that animals make that have that, but we get further than that. You know, we say things like, I just saw a tiger over the hill.
Yeah,
entirely.
You know, we add that our the reach of our language is or that's
time and space encompassing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
We can lie about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's not go there yet. Let's not go in. Let's not go there. But what he's saying here is, but now it's become absolutely fundamental to our life. If we couldn't language together, our whole civilization would collapse, and we would be left, you know, unable to cope.
Because everything else would whizzing away, but language.
Yes. Yes.
It's
a kind of a historical thing where we stumbled across it almost by accident without it being a necessity. But as soon as we embrace it, then it informs the world that we live in, and then it becomes a necessity.
Mm.
So it's not that you have to look back into evolution and say, why was language necessary? It wasn't necessary, but as soon as you have it, then over time it becomes necessary.
Silent orders
are all exist within a language and culture, so that everybody already knows the names of things. They're not rare. There's no such thing as silence for creatures like us. Not like that. There's you abstain from language, but you still have it. Yeah, no, but you're just the way they look at each other, right? It's full of language.
Just the
rising of an eyebrow, you know. So this is I've been referring to this, and I did last time. So I want to slam through it because, you know, I know the food's being passed around. I know what that means. We're getting through part one of the lecture. So. Neoteny. I had to look. You know, the internet's great, isn't it? When you get a word like that, neoteny. I still hear that little robotic voice. How do you pronounce it, Google? Neoteny. Okay.
Or
neoteny. Yeah, neoteny. Or no, I'd like the English one. Neoteny. Yeah. That's
and what does it mean?
It means the what we were talking about, the extension of childlike behaviours and physical characteristics into adulthood. And this isn't something that Maturana's made up. It's well recognised that this is what's happened in the human race, this extension of childhood into adulthood. Is this where he says, I don't think he does here. I think it was in an earlier slide where he says, we basically have children in the middle of our own infancy. That's really what, or we know we don't actually ever really leave our state of childhood. We just remained in childhood, and the idea here is we remained in childhood because we remained in the orbit of love that came originally out of the mother, and the mother creates that orbit of love with the child and has many children, and the argument that's coming is that she includes man in it, or man starts to join in, so it's a kind of a story of the extension of mother love, I think, into the domain of the entire family, so that the entire family remains in the orbit of mother love, but mother love becomes sexual love. So that we've got that secondary expansion that was totally necessary, where the female of the species remains interested in sexual intimacy throughout the year, not just at special times for reproduction, and the whole domain of sexuality starts to become a place of play as well. It starts to be freed up from necessity and starts to become a kind of a game where the point is enjoyment, because we start to learn to enjoy ourselves. And the animals have this too, you know. If you have a dog, the animals have it too. But the animals are a bit. You're reminding me of it. Yeah, that's okay, up to a certain point, and then you're off, mate, because it's a cruel world out there. But in a way, what Maturana is saying is, but we were able to form groups, if you like, where the cruel world was at the boundary of a loving group. So we were able to create a space of love and maintain a space of love, and that maintaining of the space of love is what formed our bodies. Or in this flow of evolution, it influenced the form of our bodies.
I wonder when sex became taboo.
Church religion. Well, we're talking again about paternalism, property, agriculture, civilization, aren't we?
So I didn't catch that last sentence that you just mentioned prior to the idea of paternalism, property, and civilization. What was the thing?
Why sex became a taboo then?
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks.
So this is the key message. Right, is the biology of love. That's what distinguishes the human race, the human animal. It's we that took something that the mammals developed in the bringing up of the offspring. We as a species massively expanded it so that it became our way of life.
Wouldn't there have also been push to leave the group or at least merge with another group, because constant interbreeding in a small group is
yes
problematic.
Yes, I mean there must be a bigger story here about the ejected males, you know, who are thrown out, right?
Yeah.
Because we can only sustain family groups of a certain size, and he's specifically mentioned around about 8 seems to be a good size to maintain intimacy. It's quite interesting with group dynamics. You know, in psychology, dialogue groups there's family size groups, and then there's an intermediary place where you can have dialogue groups. Where you're not in the loving intimacy, because loving intimacy is all physical as well. It's all about touch. But there's a larger intimacy of dialogue, and this is just in our time, not in historically, which seems to be around about 14 to 18 people. It's the sort of sweet spot for something 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, around about this size. Few more people, few less, but if you get it into the 20 plus, then you start getting factions. You get us over here and you over there, like where we live at the Poplars. You know, it's a little housing estate. There's the southern group and the northern group. You know, which is it's yes,
we didn't know that.
Yes. Of course, the southern group are the best. Yeah, we all live around a green, and this has all been created because there's a road goes through the middle of the green. And there's all of that. This isn't saying that all of that isn't there, because there's the other group. You know, there's always the other group. Yeah, and all of that brutality that we don't have in the family is there for the other group who might want to move in on our little heavenly world, you know, out in the savannah. We don't know how that went, but certainly it wouldn't have been all flowers and roses. So this whole page on female sexuality we did look into last week. But the gist of it's there, right? Because he's saying this is foundational. This is before language. before language, there had to be this growth of sexual intimacy. It wasn't just enough, the intimacy of the mother and the child. It had to include the man, the adult, and the adult woman, the two adults coming together, and expanding and retaining that space of love together throughout the whole length of life. The sense of unity and cooperation and consensuality. And why would you do that? Well, this is the mysterious thing, you see, because we enjoy it. This is, if there's, and if you, you know, I don't like to bring God in. Don't like to bring God in, but you can bring the good in if you like. We don't like God anymore, but if we can put another O in, we do have the good. Where does the good come from? Why should it be good? Why should it be good for us to cooperate? Why should it be good for us to touch each other? And I know over here there's a guy here from the, you know, from the universe, endorphins, mate. It's endorphins. It's all to do with chemicals. Yeah. No. Why should we experience a certain chemical being released as being good? I'll just throw that onto the table, right? Because you can't explain all of this mechanically. The good is good because it's good. Yes, something's enjoyable because it's enjoyable. Even if you say endorphins are enjoyable, well, they're not, are they? They're just a molecule, and a molecule is not enjoyable. And you might say, oh, well, because you've got less tension. Well, why is less tension enjoyable?
Just because people recognise you and value you.
Yes. It's all going on in another dimension, isn't it?
Yeah.
Another dimension of meaning.
If love was just endorphins, you wouldn't be like partners, because you would just be in love with whoever was near you, and then you'd move on. So why do you have like...
Well, exactly.
Familiarity.
I'm just throwing this on the table just to say that my sense is that the fact that we love is to do with love, and the being of love is not it becomes manifest on earth when we engage in certain behaviours, but the behaviours aren't love, and yet they're. Do you see they're? They go together. Love is another dimension of loving behaviour. So we're just. I'm just trying to say something that again, isn't being said here. If we were just robotic entities, it would mean nothing to us, whether we were stabbing each other or making love. Whether we were having endorphins or whatever you get from killing something, you get a certain enjoyment.
Endorphins, I think, yeah. For a lot of people.
It triggers jealousy.
Pardon?
Love triggers jealousy.
Yes. Well, let's say mistrust. It's the collision of love with mistrust. Yeah, I would. It depends what you mean by love. The sort of love we're looking at here is the love of a group of say eight people living in the savannah. They haven't met the troubadours. They don't know about romantic love. Do you know that they don't say, "Oh, you're my soulmate." And if anyone else was to touch you, my heart would break. I don't think that they was like that. You know, it was a love that was just born of an inability to disassociate your own identity from the identity of the other. You know, a kind of emerging, really.
I feel like familiarity, because even though we all share a language, your language, the way you communicate with your family becomes unique, and you have things that only each other can understand. And I suppose you're like building this virtual invisible world. Your family makes that.
Yes.
You love that. It's a it's not just the building of your home, but that place that you want to inhabit. And
yes.
If you build that out of, for your love to live in.
Yes.
Create your language. Yeah.
And you make something.
Yes.
Through being together, through
yes.
time, and through adversity.
Yes.
You know that there's something happens between human. You know, I admitted that I've just recently a weakness for watching Strictly Come Dancing.
Oh, no.
it was Nicolette's mum started it. She came and she insisted on watching it, but people keep on falling in love.
Mm-hmm.
The partners.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's I don't want to be kind of disparaging about love, but I think you'd be amazed how many people you could fall in love with if you were just put together and put through something, and you had to help each other. Do you know, love isn't such a rare thing between human beings.
Some people stick and some don't. It's like you meet many potential friends, but some people stick and remain your friend.
Yes.
And you can make that friend. You can't make the friendship with everybody.
Yes.
So not everybody on Strictly falls in love.
No. No, I don't wish to use Strictly as the Yes, we can, but we're going to say loving cooperation, and there's Nicolette if you want to know. Engaged in some loving cooperation when she was working on the pediatric ward, looking after the kids with cancer. I'd just like to throw that in to say there are still modes of being together here where it's still loving cooperation, even though you know, the world is out to close it down. Well, pretty much. There's a kind of a.
But that's working in a team as well.
Yes.
With others. But for one thing, for a purpose, everyone has the same purpose.
But I just like to drive again that there's a dimension here where the truth of what Maturana is saying. So in a way, you have to read it back into your own experience. And if you've ever had an experience of working together with people where what you're doing together is not about making money, it's you're doing something because you all feel that it's intrinsically valuable, so you're not doing it for yourself anymore, and that it transforms the whole manner of your being together. It starts to form what I was saying with the fact you start to form a loving place, and you start to love the other people who you're working with, because you're all putting yourself aside to some extent or other, and it's very easy for us as human beings to get into such a state. It's just there are very, very few opportunities to live like that. You know, we live in a world that's structured in a different way.
So is it more natural for us to be together in groups?
Well, it's more natural for me. But I go back to the beginning of the class. So why don't we live like this? That's the question. And why, when we do live like this, does it usually not last for long? Well, quite often it's because it is a matter of the pension, right? We do have to make money. You know, there's the call of the world, but I feel like throwing on the table again. Why does that matter more to us?
No, that is a good question, because I think it does matter more.
Yes,
it does matter more. It's sorry to be this kind of
yeah.
guy again.
No, but it does.
Like love is all nice when it kind of fits inside the realm of this. Darwinian. So I'm not a Darwinian kind of, by default, but I'm just kind of beg to defer that it's like, okay, love, intimacy gave rise to language, and then it turns out that language is really great for survival because we can coordinate the coordination and do everything with it. But now, it's like, well, so it's nice that love fits in. When love fits in with survival, it's great. But if it's love or survival, I would go with survival.
Yes. Yes, I mean, one of the things that is these rings of cooperation, loving cooperation, often require some kind of hostile environment to emerge, like the presence of cancer and the death of children. It's a sufficiently terrible, tragic. I mean, in a way, you say actually what it happens is people fucking wake up, but that's the one way of putting it. But generally, the Second World
War. Wake up.
What way
mothers say to me, I'm not in that at the moment, but the mothers would say to me, you know, they'd be driving up to Brisbane to take their kid to have treatment for their cancer, and they would be, you know, they'd say to me, it's just everything else becomes, you know, people's the way that they talk, everything become, it doesn't become important anymore. Survival, yes, but their perception of the world and how we are generally from day to day becomes very unimportant. What their friends will say and how their life, what's important to people outside of what they're not, which aren't going through it, it all becomes superficial, and that the important thing is love, and the important thing is that their child survives.
Yeah.
You know, and that they get the right treatment, but it becomes incredibly important.
Yeah.
Like really important.
Yeah, but if their life themselves, the thing about survival is that it's more powerful, in my opinion, because a mother would consider like even eating her own child if she was like starving to death. This stuff is even written. It has happened.
Yeah.
It has
happened.
And it happens in an extreme situation of survival where not everybody is behaving altruistically, even mothers and their own children. So it's like this, and I'm not saying it because I've got anything against love, I'm all up for love, but I'm just saying we need to kind of not think that we are viewing things because we like to see it like this.
We're not saying that, are we? We're saying that there were groups of people who lived together in a loving place, and also just making the point that partly that was because they were absolutely, utterly dependent on each other for survival. And Nicolette's situation in the hospital was like that. And you see the documentaries on the guys from the Second World War, the ones that survived and are still with us. They're all in tears within a few minutes about what happened and how they loved the people they served with. Do you know that this circle of love between people it seems to require the 60s, right? The 60s, Vietnam War. You know, there's always something.
So it's maybe then really, however cheesy it sounds, but maybe love is just that bond that holds these people together in groups, and it's an evolutionary a necessity in a way, but somehow smartly our hormones bind us with love through the people around us, so we stay together with
but
them.
With, when we say smartly, what Maturana is saying is, well, no, we discovered this.
It was a conscious decision.
Yeah, not exactly, it was you could say accidental, but we discovered this mode of behaviour and it worked for us. So we weren't tricked into it, and there was no kind of ulterior survival motive behind it. It just occurred, and it thrived because we loved it.
But love does trigger endorphins, doesn't it? And endorphins make us feel happy. I think, I don't know what else you get endorphin release from, but if you eat sweets, I think, and other pleasant things. So that would be released if we're in loving company. And that would mean that we want more of it.
Yes.
We seek it. So
yes, but I've got to say just to everyone here, that's one way of putting it. The other way of putting it is, yes, but how does love actually feel? How
anti-phenomenological explanation.
Yeah, it's we don't love because of the endorphins. We love because of what it is to love. And I'm talking about the quality of what it is to love. How can I put it any differently?
What is an endorphin?
Well, Maria's going to cook. Maria's. I'm going to have to can it. We're going to have lunch.
Oh no! Don't start on the. Don't.